Hi, it's Tracy. Before we start, I have a request. Okay, it's a little weird, maybe even a lot weird, but hello, 6.5 million downloads on my podcast, and still we haven't chosen a sponsor, right? Yeah, they just haven't been good enough for us, and that's a little weird too. So I decided I'm going to treat this like a sponsorship spot. Many of you know Marcus, my son, who's been the inspiration behind this podcast, the book, my programs, anything at all to do with ADHD. Well, he is graduating from NYU this May, and boy, are we happy that he did it in 4 years. So anyway, Marcus loves to travel, and so he's spending 6 weeks by himself traveling to 5 countries in South America. I don't know about you, but there's no way in hell that I would go to even one country alone. And so we gave Marcus a very low budget. This trip is a combination of his birthday and graduation gift, and he figured it all out himself. He speaks some Spanish, but he hired a Spanish tutor from Ecuador a couple weeks ago, months maybe, who's a professor at a university there, and this professor is helping him with his conversational Spanish. Marcus also changed his phone to Spanish only and all of his apps, and he only watches Spanish TV in preparation for this trip. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what Marcus is like. Now, Marcus would ultimately like to earn a PhD in psychology. He's fascinated by the brain, learning differences, and particularly how dyslexia impacts math. For the near future, though, he wants to work for a couple of years in New York City. I never thought he'd say that. He was always looking for more nature. So anyway, he's going on this trip, and what he's trying to do is find a job that he can come back to. He's come very close, but still no cigar. So yes, I am hawking my son's skills on these airwaves. He thinks I'm insane. But I'm like, who knows what interesting people are out there? I mean, I found my husband in a personal ad when no one was doing that. So why not find a job using my podcast? I mean, ultimately, finding a partner or finding a job, it's all the same thing, right? It's marketing, just getting the word out. Right job, right person. So that's my weird request. If you have any leads in New York City, Marcus would love to work in advertising or marketing sales. He's a phenomenal researcher. I promise you, he can find anything. He's very skilled in Excel and financial modeling. He'd be amazing in digital advertising or tech marketing. And beyond his hard skills, he's resilient. He's so smart. And he has an exceptional work ethic. And that's not just his mother talking. He's not like me. He prefers not to challenge the status quo all the time. He actually likes structure and systems. And he has so many ideas about how to make things better, faster, more efficient, simpler. So I'm putting this out there to our incredible community. If you know of any opportunities in digital advertising, tech marketing, or sales that are in New York City and could benefit from a bright, hardworking, and respectful young professional like my son Marcus, send me an email at support@tracyoutsuka.com and I will connect the two of you. Look, Marcus represents the very essence of what we talk about here every week, right? The brilliance of thinking differently. And so does his mother. So thank you for letting me be weird. And now let's get on with the show.
Richard Branson, Michael Phelps, Justin Timberlake, James Carville. Wait a minute. Where are the women? Greta Gerwig, Lisa Ling, Audra McDonald, Simone Biles. That sounds like a list of highly successful titans in a variety of industries. They all have ADHD, but you don't hear much about that now, do you? You know what else you don't hear about? Are the 43% of people with ADHD who are in excellent mental health. Why aren't we talking about them and what they're doing right? I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka, and that's exactly what we do here. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, a lifelong student, and now the author of my new book, ADHD for Smart-Ass Women. I'm also a certified ADHD coach and the creator of Your ADHD Brain is A-OK, a patented system that helps ADHD women just like you get unstuck and fall in love with their brilliant brains. Here, we embrace our too muchness and we focus on our strengths. My guests and I credit our ADHD for some of our greatest gifts. And to those who still think they're too much, too impulsive, too scattered, too disorganized, I say, no one ever made a difference by being too little.
Hello, hello, hello. It's Tracy Otsuka. I am your host of ADHD for Smartass Women. Thank you so much for joining us here for yet another episode. You know what my purpose is. It is always to show you who you are and then inspire you to be it. In the thousands of ADHD women that I've had the privilege of meeting, I've never met a one that wasn't truly brilliant at something, not one. And our guest today, she's no different. I am just delighted to introduce you to Caitlin Dougherty. Caitlin, did I pronounce your name right? That was one thing I forgot to ask you.
Much closer than a lot of folks. Dougherty.
Dougherty?
Yep.
Okay. It's always the second time, isn't it? Okay. So here we go. Caitlin Dougherty. Caitlin is a therapeutic yoga and movement practitioner, animal lover, and curious human. She also teaches yoga at an eating disorder clinic. With lived experience as an autistic woman with ADHD and pathological demand avoidance, Caitlin is going to tell us all about what that is. She struggles with mental and chronic illness and holds space for folks who have been left out of traditional wellness spaces to connect back to the body just as it is. She does this through her company, Mindful Movements for, Mindful Movement for Misfits. Caitlin, welcome. And did I get all of that right?
Whew, you got it. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sometimes I meet people, Caitlin, and I literally feel like they are so calm and so centered. And they're almost like their back is up against the wall because I'm just like this wind that's blown in. And I feel that with you. But for me, at least, it is extremely calming. So thank you for being here.
Good. That's my goal. Yeah, is to kind of bring that presence in as much as I can. So I'm glad.
Well, you certainly do. And if you've listened to any of our podcast episodes, you know that we always start by talking about the ADHD diagnoses first. I'm sure the autism is going to get mixed in with that. But can you tell me, when were you diagnosed with ADHD?
Yes. So I was diagnosed when I was in my late teens, early, you know, kind of like college, university time, which, having to manage your own school and your own workload. And that's when it really became apparent that something was different, that everything was really hard too.
Not to mention laundry and getting yourself fed and getting to bed on time and all of those things, right?
Yes, absolutely. Those like life skills that I don't feel like many of us get access to, really. So I told my mother that I thought like I might have ADHD, and I went in and took this really simple assessment, which still feels really incomplete knowing what I know now. And he was like, yep, you have ADHD. Okay.
Was that it?
That was it. That was it.
And was it, here's a prescription, try this.
Not even that.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. How do you do that to someone?
Yeah.
You literally just diagnose them with something they know nothing about and then just say, bye.
Yep.
That's cruel.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of feel that in my body as we're talking about that and how just unfortunate that is and how so many of us can probably relate to a similar experience of being diagnosed or not being diagnosed or, yeah. I did get on medication shortly after and haven't been on it since. But yeah, it was this very confusing, muddled experience of, it felt very disembodied is the word I would use. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you were diagnosed with ADHD, it sounds like you already kind of had a sense that that's what it was. Was it a relief, or were you kind of depressed just given how it was just all dumped on you later? Bye.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say the latter. It didn't feel good. I didn't feel like I had more information. I felt like I had this label that didn't make a lot of sense. I didn't have tools for managing it. I also didn't have family that really didn't and don't have family that really understand and can support it. And so that's always been a really fraught, place for me. And thankfully now I'm in a place where I can take care of myself, educate myself, get the tools I need. But certainly it was not a, beautiful, glamorous experience or feeling. Yeah.
It was not inspiring or empowering at all.
Exactly.
So you got this diagnosis and then you just put it on the shelf?
Yeah, for a long time. I mean, I would say until the last 2 years. And, you know, I'm 32 now, so I lived through my entire 20s with this like label, but not really an understanding or the tools to support that.
Right after you got diagnosed, it sounded like you went to a psychiatrist and got prescribed medication. It didn't work. Were the symptoms worse than the symptoms of the medication worse than the symptoms of ADHD?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And that was kind of, and, you know, we don't live in a world where it's like, let's try things and let's experiment and let's ask questions. We live in a world that's like, here's a pill. It should work for you. Well, what if it doesn't, right? What's the step? What's the next step? Yeah. Or like, what else can we try?
We try another pill.
Yeah. Yeah. So, just very Western medical, you know, experience.
Right. We take the mind and we take the body and we separate them.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. So then what happened? Like, you know, you went through life, hopefully things went fairly well, but then something happened at 32.
So I was living in New York City and about 22 to 27, 28. And during those years were probably the most unglamorous, difficult times in my life. I was working 9-to-5 jobs that I couldn't do. And now we know why. There's also an autism diagnosis that comes in there, but basically in a place of extreme burnout, probably the entire time I was there.
What kind of work were you doing?
I was working for a couple of different startups doing, you know, I was right out of school. I was kind of doing whatever, customer service, admin, events, all very overstimulating roles.
How did you end up in New York City? Talk about overstimulating. I'm leaving tonight for New York City, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, very lost in who I was, and my sister was there and was living there. And I'd always wanted to live in a big city. I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina, which is where I am now, but always just kind of wanted to like flee the nest, experience something else. Why not the biggest city? Why not the biggest city and most
overstimulating? Isn't that so ADHD though?
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah,
like,
it really
the bigger
is.
The better.
Yeah, totally.
So what happened at 30 that kind of made everything turn around?
Yeah.
Is that when you were diagnosed with autism, or did you say it was before then?
Autism is in the last year. It was March of last year that I realized it. So it's not even been a year. Here's what really happened was the knowledge that I was gaining from Instagram and TikTok and Facebook that was greater than, you know, the information was there. And I was like, I really relate with a lot of these stories. And I was reminded, oh yeah, I'm ADHD too. That was in kind of pushed away, right? I didn't take a lot of time to understand that. And then I was in a creative care for neurodivergent folks, like art therapy group. And there were a lot of autistic women and people assigned female at birth. And I was like, I am definitely autistic as well. And that actually felt like a moment that explained my entire life.
Wow.
Knowing
that. So it wasn't
that.
The ADHD, it was the autism that, yeah. I don't know, really just resonated.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's because it was a different experience, the ADHD learning and the autism learning. So maybe that has something to do with it. Mm. But the autistic experience was something that I felt like I could connect with on a different level than ADHD.
Yeah.
And I do feel they are separate, but they do intertwine a lot too.
But you feel like the autism drive is the driver.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And I've noticed that, you know, all these labels, right? And especially with ADHD and, you know, the comorbidities, you have one, the chances you have another are like, you know, pretty much a given. In fact, I've never met a woman with ADHD who doesn't also have anxiety. And of course, like it makes all the sense in the world. But I know my son, you know, he was diagnosed with ADHD and he has never really, like, he's like, yes, there's ADHD, but what drives it is dyslexia. So I've noticed that we all sort of identify with one of them, mm-hmm. one of the labels, and that seems to drive everything. And then the other ones kind of come in behind. So I find that really interesting. Okay. So it sounds like you get diagnosed with autism and that one you really could adopt. And it was much more like inspiring. Than the ADHD diagnoses. Like you could wrap your head around that one and could you be proud of it? Could you be proud of, oh, well, this is how my brain works, but look at all the strengths of it? Or were you still struggling with all of the problems?
I think a little bit of both. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I think it felt more supportive given the environment that I kind of realized it within. And I read the book, I was reading the book, is it Divergent Mind, Janara Nuremberg?
Yes.
That is the book that I, that was like, oh, this explains everything. So I think it felt it felt more embodied. It felt more, supportive. And it was still like, I'm now, you know, kind of focusing on the label. I'm now realizing I'm an autistic person. Like there's a lot of cultural heaviness around that label. So it was a little bit of both, I think. That feels right.
Do you think though, the cultural heaviness it's all around people that don't know.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to someone yesterday. I can't even remember who it was, but there was a time when I thought autism. Well, if I'm talking to you and I'm in a, you know, career and you're there and you happen to be autistic, I'm just going to assume number one, it's Asperger's, right? So, which I don't know, they don't want to use that term anymore, but I just feel like we need more terms that kind of identify, you know, what your experience is. So I think Asperger's, I think of someone who's not very social, who's not really interested in, you know, getting to know me. This is all baloney, by the way, but that's what I would have thought in the past, you know, but the more I'm around women, and I'm primarily around women with ADHD, but a lot of them also have autism and, or identify as autistic. I love these women. And I find that there's something about the ADHD brain and the autistic brain that makes for real success, you know, whatever success means to you in terms of being able to achieve their goals, because you've got that fearlessness and the why not from the ADHD, but you're always kind of being pulled back into reality more, right? With the autism that likes the structure and likes the systems, and that actually helps the ADHD brain too. So I don't know. What do you think about that? And so when we are around our people, these people, and I consider you our people,
you really get the beauty of that brain, of your brain, because we understand. I mean, I can't say, you know, I've not been diagnosed with autism, so I cannot say I understand your experience at all. But I just love, it's just so interesting to me to be around people that think differently, you know, that don't do the, oh, jump in line, follow along, and instead are asking the why, and are you sure? And, you know, have you thought about this? Like, I love that, that hyper-focus and curiosity.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for saying all of that. I recently listened to your episode on, and I can't even remember the title, but these kind of the, what you just said, asking why, being what culture, our culture might call like defiant, difficult, and the other words that you used. Yeah. I really do think, thank you for saying that. I think my brain working in this way with both autism and ADHD is such a superpower that I am learning to really appreciate and love about myself and the things that I, as a child, the things that were troubling for others about me as a child, I'm starting to lean back into those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there was a lot of the too much, but not enough, you know, I was always singing a song or performing something. And so I'm trying to get back to that, because that's, you know, I did improv when I was in New York and I loved it. And
I bow down to you. And so many women with ADHD, they do that. And I'm like, that is the most horrifying thing ever. But I also think it's the autism, which makes you brilliant at it, because there's something about words and memory. And I don't know. I don't think you struggle as much as like someone like me does with that part.
That, yeah. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I would agree with that. And it's almost like, because there's improv is all about not having a filter and saying whatever's on your mind. Autistic people are very good at that. And in a way that really highlights that as a, such a great quality, rather than something that is, you know, or cringy or whatever.
Well, the deal with comedy though, right, is it's funny because it's true. And so it's not like if you're autistic, you're shooting your mouth off of stuff that makes no sense. It's like, they're just saying what's the truth, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of us in a lot of us who are neurodivergent, whatever, however we identify within that, are often working towards the truth, right? We're asking why, like you said, we're asking questions, we're curious, we're trying to push the boundaries. We're like, oh, I've been put in this box and I don't want to be.
Yeah.
So
trying to understand, right?
Right. Exactly.
So I had asked before and then I stopped myself and then you alluded to it again. So tell me what Caitlin was like as a child.
Yeah. There is a lot that I don't remember. And I will say, like, I think some of that is a bit of a protective measure, maybe some trauma around being too much, around being different, around not being accepted and needing to fall in line. So there's a lot that I don't remember, but what I do remember is that the highs and the lows, very, very emotional. I'm just a watery, emotional person, like just, you know, in the depths of the emotion and then in the very extremes and highs of the emotion and everywhere in between. And that, I mean, mood swings, anxiety, depression, like these are things that we talk about. Yeah. We talk about neurodivergence too. And always singing a song, always right, acting or performing. And also had trouble with friendships in a way that, like I was always kind of on the fringes or left out a bit, or yeah. And that feeling is very real and very much how I experienced. There was always something I like didn't quite get about being in friendships or being in social settings or.
Yeah. And I can understand how, if you feel like you, if you felt like you were too much, as a child, right? So I'm assuming from like family, and then you feel like you don't quite understand the social structures around relationships with girls and other kids. That would be really traumatic. That would be really hard. And so you're always wondering, why am I always, I always use the term black sheep, right? Mm-hmm. Or the canary in the coal mine, as you know, yeah, some of us can relate to, right? You're so honest. And so you're actually pointing out things that are truthful, that are, it's your experience. That's what's going on. And then you have people that are denying it and saying, oh no, too much, too this, too that, right? Mm-hmm. Just fit in and be quiet and go along.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and that label of like, I think we as a society love to talk about like difficult children or like misbehaving, mm-hmm, you know, children mm-hmm that misbehave. Right.
Our brightest children, I might add.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that is a big theme. I feel from that a lot of us can relate to is that.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned was something called PDA, which is, what's the acronym for? Something demand avoidance.
Pathological demand avoidance.
Psychological demand avoidance. So what is that? And why is it often linked with autism? Maybe ADHD too, huh?
Yeah.
But maybe they call it oppositional defiant disorder. And I'm like, well, what's the difference?
Oh, I have so much to say about this, working in the mental health field. So,
yeah, so do I. Certainly about oppositional defiant disorder. It's like, yes, yeah, ugh, that's a thing. Okay.
Makes me, yeah, mm-hmm, makes me, ugh. So pathological demand avoidance, they're also saying like pervasive desire for autonomy is kind of like a way to flip the name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like that. So,
is that basically stop telling me what to do? I know what I need to do for me.
Yeah, it's, I think for me, it's the demand that you place on me by saying, by telling me what to do is not only am I going to say, I'm not going to do it now because you've told me.
Oh, that totally sounds like me. But if you make me think that I came up with the idea, bingo.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if there's some sort of hierarchy that's rebalanced from that, yeah, like that's really how I relate to it is the consent and the hierarchy. And if the mm-hmm balance is off, like I am always working as the PDA-er to rebalance the scale of, equality really is what it feels like.
Ah. So do you think part of that though is this ADHD? And I think autistic people have this too. This justice sensitivity, right? And fairness. And who are you to tell me what to do? First, we're equal. I don't care who you are. And then you earn my respect and I'll earn your respect. If I really respect you, and this was my son with teachers, I will go to the moon and back for you. But if you're going to sit there and tell me what to do and I don't mm-hmm respect you, I'm going to fight you the whole way. Mm-hmm. Is that basically your experience too?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there is too, like there is demand avoidance or there is, right, oppositional. It's so complex, of course. I think there can be qualities of PDA that a lot of people experience. And then there's PDA might be, you know, the more extreme or intense or version of that. And I think how I like to think about PDA is like you have a bucket of demands every day. So you only, and it's kind of like the spoon theory for people with chronic illness. You have a bucket of demands. And if you, like, if my partner asks me a certain number of questions on a given day, and I also have to work that day, and I also have to shower that day, and I also have to, there's only a number of demands that I can work with in a day, depending on where I'm at. And of course there's probably so much more to it, but that's, those are kind of how I relate to, relate to PDA. And I think that, well, I'll pause there.
Well, what I'm thinking is that it's almost like you just have so much bandwidth, and some of us may get a little bit aggressive and in other people's faces, probably me, I would raise my hand, not aggressive, but just like, why, you know, but then others of us may just shut down because it's just too much, right? The demands are too much. And we've just learned that that's how we protect ourselves. Because we've tried to do it, right? We've tried to do all the things. We've tried to do it their way. It hasn't worked. And so honestly, we probably fall a little bit more into learned helplessness, where instead of even dealing with it, we just shut it all down.
Yeah, it's just too much sometimes.
Do you draw a distinction between oppositional defiant disorder, which I mean, just all these disorder, all these friggin' labels, right? But you know, a lot of kids in jail, prisons, are diagnosed with ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder. And then there's psychological demand avoidance. What do you see a distinction between those? Like maybe it's the psychological demand avoidance that ends up causing the oppositional defiant disorder, right? Which isn't even, and I use those labels, but I'm kind of, I'm using them like making fun of them, because I just, I think that every person wants to be seen. Every child wants to be seen and heard and feel like they're important. And when we don't, then you can understand why we would start to get angry, right? Who are you that don't even know me? You know what it was? I had someone on the podcast last week, and she was actually institutionalized and required to take medication. And they had this whole group in the juvenile system that she was part of. Once she got to that hospital, they started to teach her how to deal with it. And she was misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder, was being, you know, forced to take lithium. It was making her much sicker. She had ADHD. And all these kids were actually the ones protecting her, not the doctors. And finally, there was a resident who came in and said, look, I think she's got ADHD. Let's try stimulant medication. They tried stimulant medication, but the head doctor, head psychiatrist, he was mad and he didn't want to do it, because this was an underling who was telling him, I think this is what it is. I think you're wrong. Well, he was right. And so all these kids, they knew the right answer, and they're fighting against this institution, all these medical professionals. And I don't even know where I'm going with this other than they knew the right answer. They knew in a much better way how to tap into who they are and what they need. And they knew what they needed for themselves better than these doctors did. And so ultimately, you know, that's why she's doing the work she's doing, but this is happening every day, right?
Yeah, I think you touched on a really, really important point. That's the struggle, right? Is, yeah, just what you described. If we are different, but we aren't taught how to harness that difference, that's a difficult place to be, because then we always feel like we're pushing up against something, the very thing that makes us neurodivergent and makes us want to advocate for ourselves and ask questions is then, I mean, what an interesting example is then squashed by someone who's in a higher position or in a place of authority. I think that's just such.
Yeah. And I think, as you were saying, this happens in families all the time, right? The difference is what makes us so brilliant. And when we come out, like you said, you're singing, you're dancing, anybody who'll listen. But when that's squashed and you're that young, you don't know any better than to think there's something wrong with me. Instead of, no, I'm perfectly right the way I am. There's something wrong with them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it.
There's something you do that's going to be perfect segue for this that I really love. Unlike me, who I'm asked a question, I just blah, 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 blah. And then I process it as I'm talking. So people like me, I think, can often not come across as smart because we're fumbling through the words on what we're thinking out loud, versus what you do is I can tell you get into your body. And you've said a couple things to that effect as we're talking. You don't feel this need to just shoot an answer out. You bring it inside and you kind of sit with it for a while before you formulate how you want to respond. And so I want to know, is that just who you are, or is that intentional? Is that something you've learned?
What a great question. As I sit here and pause.
You realize you're like that though, right?
I don't know.
You're not a vomit all over people. You're very deliberate and thoughtful.
Yeah. Thank you. It's lovely to hear that reflected back. And I think that is why I do the work I do. Perhaps when I really question the work that I do, I'm reminded it's a calling, right? It's this sensation in my body that's saying you must do this. It's
okay. Well, then that just is the perfect segue. So the reason I thought you would be such a good fit for this podcast is we all know the benefits of movement for not only the mind, but also the body. But so many people that I come across, certainly with ADHD, probably ADHD and dyslexia, probably ADHD and, you know, autism and all the other ones, they have this visceral yuck reaction when they hear the term exercise. I don't even use it anymore because that word exercise is so charged with negative emotion that they just can't get past it. And so what I love is, so I always use the term movement now. Mm-hmm. What I love is how you meet people where they are. And I'd love for you to talk more about that and talk a little bit about what it is that you do and why you are called to it. I always believe our best purposes give meaning to our past. So I suspect this is something you've learned for yourself first.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great place to start. I think that's some of what you're explaining is a bit of a learned skill of, slowing down. I mean, and not that it's, I don't want to place good and bad on slowing down or moving quickly, because I don't think anything in itself is good or bad. I think we have a whole spectrum of experiences and things, but learning to take a breath, slow down, that's been very beneficial for me. And so that's something that I bring into my work. And as you were saying, with a history of an eating disorder and diet culture being very pervasive in my life, there was also this need to redefine movement. And I love that you use the word movement, because I do too. And I think it feels much better than exercise. Redefine movement, redefine the relationship we have to our bodies, to ourselves, to our self-care. So I've been on my own journey of kind of undoing the Western culture view.
Caitlin, can you talk a little bit about your journey, how you ended up here? Why are you even interested in this subject?
The eating disordered past certainly informs a lot of that. And then there's all these other pieces of who Caitlin is that we've kind of talked about. And when I was in New York and when I left New York, it felt like the before and after of Caitlin. Like before is, you know, the not very self-compassionate, trying to fit into a box, trying to be really thin, trying to be all these things that I was not.
What society, the messages. Yeah.
Yep. And in every way, right? In jobs, mm-hmm. friendships, sexuality, body, everything, all the ways. And then leaving New York is kind of what I describe as like the after and the new embodied version of Caitlin, who is who she really is. And that started with food. And the food and the diet culture started to unravel everything. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm.
what does that mean?
Yeah, I started to realize that I had an eating disorder, that I was chronically dieting my entire life, pretty much, that I wasn't actually feeding myself based on what I needed or what felt good or yeah, what my body was like, oh, you need this nutrient. It was, you have to eat according to this plan that, you know, you can't have these foods. You can have these foods. You can only have this much. You have to eat at these times so that your body can be smaller. And I learned about intuitive eating. And that was my kind of introduction to, oh, there's a different, oh my gosh, people eat just food without, you know, really analyzing it all the time. 90% of my life was thinking about food and my body. And there's this freedom that comes from not thinking about those things all of the time in a really negative way.
What is your ideal? I don't know if you call them students or clients, or what do they typically look like?
Mm-hmm.
Not physically, but you know, the makeup.
Yeah. I typically support people in larger bodies. I am in a larger body myself. I typically, and of course there's a neurodivergent people, mm-hmm. Chronically mentally ill people. And often what's happened is that many of us have these overlapping experiences or identities. So often someone will come to me and, they have a little bit from this area, a little bit from that area, and it all kind of intersects, you know, chronic illness and a history of an eating disorder and neurodivergent. And that's pretty common to have, you know, kind of these overlapping experiences or neurodivergent and queer. And again, there's a lot that supports, you know, we don't fit into the box in all of the ways, you know? And so I support people who often fall outside of that box in like one or more ways and haven't received affirming care for those identities, have received, you know, ideas, advice that doesn't fit them at all.
What are they hoping to achieve? Like, why do they come to you?
I want to learn to move my body and relate to my body in a way that is compassionate and kind.
It's me again, Tracy. You know how people often assume that if you have ADHD, you're just lazy, unmotivated, and not living up to your full potential? Well, I'm here to tell you they've got it all wrong, except for the part about not reaching your full potential. But that's only because you haven't found the right strategies tailored for your unique ADHD brain. And that's exactly why I wrote ADHD for Smartass Women. This book, it's designed to help you understand the different approaches that work for your distinct brain, inspiring you to become the best version of yourself right now. You can grab a copy wherever books are sold. And if you've already read my book, please take a moment to leave a review on Amazon and Goodreads. Your feedback, it not only supports me and my publisher, but it also helps other smart-ass women and their kids, friends, and colleagues find the strategies they need to thrive. Every review makes a huge difference. So go write a review now or buy the book now before you forget. Okay, back to our usual programming. So they've struggled with movement in the past, but they know that it's something they want to do for themselves. Like they do know it would make a difference if they could learn how to do it in their way.
Yeah.
Did I get that right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what I love working with folks on is the ADHD part of me loves novelty. Mm-hmm. The autistic part of me loves routine. So what I get to do with clients is have a container to work within, space to hold for them, but then we get to create whatever we want in that space.
Yeah.
And that feels needed and different and affirming to who they are and their experience and what they want, not what society or somebody else wants.
So if there's someone listening, because I know there always are, and they're thinking, I know movement's important for me. I know it affects my brain. I know it affects my body. You know, it's like all connected. And I just feel better when I do it, but I hate doing it. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, I would first validate that experience. Yeah, and say that you're not alone in hating it, and you're not alone in struggling to get out the door or playing the video or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that we can meet you where you are in that. So if you're someone who's struggling to do, if you have set a goal for yourself to do 30 minutes of movement every day, but you're not doing it, let's try 5 minutes every day. Mm-hmm. Let's start where you are. And I think that's often, I mean, talk about neurodivergence. There's this like want and need to be perfect at something.
Yeah.
Right away. And that's okay. And I feel it too. And it's totally normal. And let's start where you are. Maybe that's the advice. Start where you are instead of where you think you should be.
Yeah, because if you say I'm going to do 30 minutes a day, and then the first day you don't do it, it's like, what? So there's no positive emotion. So mm-hmm. why would you want to go back and try again, right? I mean, it makes perfect sense. Versus if you, like you said, all you have to do, Tracy, is 5 minutes. You can do anything for 5 minutes. And if after 5 minutes you want to stop, you can stop. And mm-hmm. typically what happens is we struggle to start, but yes. then once we start, we can't stop. So if you're like, I'm going to walk for 5 minutes and you start walking, often we walk for a lot more than 5 minutes, right? Because you're already out there. You're doing it.
Yes. Yeah. And that is the thing that I struggle with most myself. I'm not immune to that either, is starting the thing. And so I would say another piece of advice that would come along with that is if you have trouble starting the thing, what do you need to do to support yourself so that you can do the thing? Maybe that's telling, I do a lot of body doubling and accountability. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's texting, setting up a text accountability chat with a friend, or setting up a virtual body doubling session where I'm going to do this during our time. What are you going to do? Let's check back in 10 minutes. I think we often think we have to push through alone, and we don't. We're not meant to do any of this alone or in isolation. So mm-hmm. what are the things that you need to feel supported so that you can start the thing?
Yeah.
And that's going to look different for each of us too.
Well, we know for our brains, we love things that are fun. We love things that are challenging, and we love things that are social. And we're so creative. Why couldn't we set something up around our goal of movement, right? That employs one or more of those things that we know works for us. Like, it doesn't have to be going to the gym. It doesn't have to be, oh, I'm going to run a marathon. Like, the only way I'm going to run a marathon is if someone is chasing me with a butcher knife. I know that about myself, right? I've never been a runner. One time I was prepping for, what do they call it out here? It's a, I don't know, it's like an 8 mile run here, Beta Breakers. And I still remember I was in college and I was up in our concrete. We had a, like a big hall that they'd bring concerts in, and the weight room was there. And I've always been really into weights, but they had a track at the top that was concrete. Like, why would they, it was literally concrete. And I don't know. I got that one time, that whatever, you know, the, in the, with the brain, when you exercise, that runner's high.
Yes.
And I literally ran 8 miles up there to train for the Beta Breakers. And I still have knee problems from it today. So not smart, right? I ultimately made the Beta Breakers, but I'm the kind of person that if I'm going to do that, I'm just going to go do it. I'm not going to train for it.
Right.
So, but I love the idea of, you know, the fun, challenging, social. And then I think what people don't understand is movement, right? It changes your brain. So it's not going to be as hard if you can just keep yourself going, like you said, even 5 minutes a day, right? You're going to and do you recommend that people really pay attention to how they feel after? Because I think we're so focused on how hard it is to start that we forget to put ourselves in that end spot when we finish and we feel so good.
Absolutely. I think of these things as rituals or things we can have intention around. Like, how do we ritualize it and make it, like you said, kind of hit these different points? Social, how is it fun? How is it, right? And how is it, how do I want to feel when I'm done? Absolutely. That's so important. Because often, at least for me, the impetus for exercising before this new relationship with movement was, I need to be smaller, right?
Yeah.
I need to burn calories. I need to lose weight. It's a very different intention. It's a very different activity when you are focused on, I want to feel a certain way.
Yes.
And I think that's so important. Yeah.
Well, there's no positive emotion in it. It's all negative emotion, right? I shouldn't all over yourself.
Yeah.
Versus I want to feel good, you know? And I know if I do this 5 minutes, not only do I feel better because I moved, but I'm also really proud of myself because I moved. And I know that makes me feel better. It's like a cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't have to look, if you're not a runner, don't be a runner. It's okay. You know, and I say that as someone who ran a half marathon, and I'm like, really proud of myself that I did that. But what? You know, I didn't really train. Like, it was an accomplishment in one way. But if we're talking about movement, it can be joyful. It can be, you don't have to hate yourself into it and out of it. You know, you can find joy and self-compassion and kindness, and it can be moving your hips in your living room to your favorite song. Like, that counts.
Yeah. So how do you work with people? Do you typically work in groups? Do you work one-to-one? How does that normally work?
Yeah, right now I work heavily one-to-one with folks, group offerings in the near future, but right now one-to-one. And, that's really, again, I really like that because I'm able to create and craft a container that feels good for that person and what they need. And that feels really good to me in the work that I do. And there's certainly benefits to group work too. And I lead yoga and eating disorder clinic and do the group work there So I like having both, but right now in terms of like, welcoming new clients, it is the one-on-one work that I really, really love and enjoy being able to, create. It's like we create our own journey. Create your own adventure, choose your adventure.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it feels like. And I really love that about it.
I love how you choose your words. Instead of create a plan, you know, you always think, oh, create an exercise plan. You said create a container, which just seems more, I hate the word abundant, but you know what I mean? It just seems like there's more choices and there's more options and there's more room in there versus a plan seems kind of limiting, right? I've got to stick with that plan versus container feels like exactly what you said, choose your own adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for reflecting that back. And it can grow. It can be smaller. It can shift and change. And it feels a little more fluid. Like what can we do? Everything, you know, we can do anything within the container. Yeah.
So how do you think movement is related to eating disorders, disordered eating, all of that, like just our relationship with it? Because I'm curious because of the yoga specifically for eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Typically what I see is a lot of folks with eating disorders, and myself included in that, have learned extreme exercise, have learned to use exercise as punishment rather than something that feels good and that's a benefit. And so that's a whole reorienting that is. And so with yoga can be such a gentle practice and is a practice of non-harm. That is like one of the tenets of yoga is non-violence, non-harm. And it was my own practice personally, and now the one I help others with, that has helped me and helps people learn to relate to their bodies and movement in a way that doesn't include violence and harm.
So for those who are struggling with disordered eating and or an eating disorder, reconnecting back to your body, is that really the answer?
I think it's one of the pieces. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of the pieces. I think where my mind goes to is that we are asked to be so cognitive. I mean, an eating disorder is about control and using, the cognition. Like what happens when we drop into our bodies instead? So reconnecting to the body does feel like it's a huge piece. And I'm also recognizing how complex that statement is and how fraught that can be. To reconnect to the body and everything that's included in that. But I do think not always operating from a cognitive place is a really beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Caitlin, what are the ADHD traits that you feel are responsible for your success?
I think like creating my own conditions, creating my own conditions in which to be successful. Like what does success look like for me? Mm-hmm. Right. And that looks very different. Drop the shoulds, drop the things, how they're supposed to be. Those things allow me to really live the life that I want. Like those are so beautiful. Yeah. And that need to like wander and adventure and have novelty. I love what that brings me to.
Beautiful. Do you have a number one ADHD workaround?
this is a big word, but the word anarchy comes to me. You know, I have a friend who we've created this term book anarchy, and we've created a way to read books that works for us. So I would say, like, just make everything up. Create your own conditions. Yeah.
So I'm curious, what is your strategy to read books?
It is, one strategy is to take a really long time to read it. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, years. Like, I pick it up maybe once a month and I read it over a year. My other strategy is to flip to a place that I feel I want to be at and read that.
Yep.
And put a story together based only on those pieces that I've absorbed.
Yeah. So basically you're applying your whole philosophy in life, right? Of just figuring out what works for you and what feels good.
Yeah.
And not beating yourself up because you haven't finished the book in a week.
Exactly. Yes. And if we go based on, back to your point about, if we go based on dropping into the body rather than what our minds think we should do.
Uh-huh.
What a beautiful way to approach life. Yeah.
And what I always think too is that every once in a while, there's a book and I literally read it in a weekend. And so my thought is always, well, if there would be better authors, maybe I would read more books.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't say read more books because I'm reading all the time, but like finish them, right?
Yes. Yeah. It has to be really good and really interesting to finish. Yeah. I'm with you. Yes. Yeah. To finish to back in a short amount of time.
In a weekend where you cannot put it down. We need more of those books. Unfortunately, yes. Or fortunately, all I read is nonfiction. 99.9%. I do have one like yours. It'll probably take me a year that I'm working on, an Ann Patchett book, because everybody tells me it's so great. I'm like, okay, so far. I can't even remember where I was going. But anyway, that I love that advice. And I think it's so true. And the thing is that what I realize is sometimes I'll just read an article. Or I'll even just read like an Instagram post, and it's so impactful, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever you're reading, you know, let's say you open a book and there is one paragraph in that whole book, but it's so impactful, then I think it's worth it picking up that book and reading it however long it takes you. Or just picking up that section and that's what you read and you don't read the rest. It still, you know, affects your life and makes a difference. Rather than, yeah. Oh my gosh, I didn't finish.
Right. Get what you get from it. Get what you need from it. Yeah. I love that. It can be a sentence or a paragraph. Right. That may be all that you need that day.
Yeah. So Caitlin, where can people find you if they want to know more about you and what you do?
Yes, I can be found on my website, which is Caitlin Doherty Wellness. com. And that's where you can check out a little bit more about me and the work that I do with folks, and where you can book a connection call so we can meet and talk about what it might look like to work together and make sure that we're a good fit for each other. Yeah.
That sounds great. And of course, we will have all of this in our show notes, Caitlin. Thank you so much for spending time with us here today. I really appreciated getting to know you.
Thank you, Tracy. We definitely talked about so many things, and it feels so good to like get into the details of all those things with you. So thank you for facilitating and leading the discussion.
Absolutely. So that's what I have for you for this week. If you like this episode with Caitlin, please let us know by leaving a review. Our goal is to change the conversation around ADHD, helping as many women as we possibly can learn how their ADHD brains work so that they too may discover their amazing strengths. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you here next week.
Don't forget, go order my book if you haven't done it, ADHDforsmartwomen.com/book. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the ADHD for Smartass Women podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka. Join us at ADHDforsmartwomen.com, where you can find more information on my new book, ADHD for Smartass Women, and my patented Your ADHD Brain is A-OK system to help you get unstuck and fall in love with your brilliant brain. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you here next week. And don't forget to sign up for our free live virtual training, 3 days to fall in love with your ADHD brain, starting on April 15th at spyhappy.me/3days. I'm telling you, it's life-changing.